Between probably neglected, people think of it as a shorthand, but if you make the next jump up and think of it as an actual operator in its own right, instead of always decomposing it, yes, I know it's equivalent, but it's one of those heuristics. You know, like, don't think of it as a ratio, think of it as a percentage, and all of a sudden the problem's clear. You can switch over and think of between as its own operator in its own right. It makes a lot of things a little bit easier. Okay, next auxiliary table, which you should automatically, yeah.
I can never remember whether between is a half open interval, a closed interval, or whatever. That's why I end up.
Yeah, it's actually it's closed. The other thing is that it's ordered. So if we say x between a and b, a should be less than b, less than or equal to b. We actually had a debate on that in the committee. This is, okay, a little war story. And somebody wanted to have it where a and b could also be swapped. A, the first did not have to be the lowest. They'd swap them around. And then they, you know, put in the paper. We voted yes on it. Somebody came back to the next meeting and said, wait a minute, nobody's ever implemented it that way, blah, blah, blah. Let's switch it back the way it was. And worry about it. Worry about the letting the user handle this particular problem. Oh yeah, you're right, chief, I'll rethink and duh. So we switched it back. However, in between those two meetings, Access to Microsoft, who never attended the meetings until they wanted to push ODBC, saw the first paper and implemented it that way in Access. If they would attend the meetings, maybe they'd know about the standard. They got better later. But IBM had the other problem. IBM would attend all the meetings in all the countries so they could push their agenda. They could overstand these groups in the old days. The joke at ISO was the sovereign nation of IBM. You watch a block vote at ISO. They have usually one guy who's the leader and he's the national representative. I'm not kidding. As I said, I'm cynical. And some days I just can't keep up. But okay, since they're not ordered, it's nice to have sequential numbering somehow. And sequential numbering, iterative loops, and all that, it's a really neat idea. I'm very proud that we invented 1, 2, 3 as human beings. And alphabetical order and stuff like that. But it's not a set concept. There's vendor extensions for getting some kind of sequence. In fact, the 99th pair now has a sequence operator in it. I don't like them. I'll get to that in a rant. But you can have a column property, the identity, in the SQL Server Sybase family. The number function, that came out of Flutcom, which is now part of Sybase. Physical locators appear in a couple of different products. There's an actual row number or physical location on a disk even. Very fast access, very non-relational. We're trying to make data abstract. We're trying to hide all of this physical implementation. So, of course, the first thing the vendors do is expose it to you because you're building on top of old file systems. Well, my sequence table is just a list of numbers. But don't start with zero. Start with one. There's a couple of little mechanical problems, like any counts and stuff, you start with zero. And if I need it, I can put other columns into this table. For example, random numbers, there's a little table of random numbers with it, number words if I need it for printing checks or whatever, and maybe some weird complicated function. But basically, I want it to be for just a simple sequence. Here's the way to get a sequential number on a result set. I can also do it with subquery. This is actually a little faster. Subqueries inside select lists are not optimized very well by any product I know of. They're essentially treated like a function call for every row in the result set. This means every row in the result set calls another query. Yeah?
It depends. It can be very optimized. The latest, for example, are able to pull up the entire substitute.
Louder so everybody else can hear it.
Latest PostgreSQL, for example, can pull up the subquery and basically run that once and put the entire subquery result into a hash table determinant.
Okay.
Then look up the hash table. So they do not need to do a real index scan or subquery execution every time.
Good. Did everybody hear? Good. It sounds nice. Now the I think the reason that it's so late in coming for the optimizers, frankly, was that, well, it was a late feature coming into SQL 92. Nobody was ready for it. And you'd already built your optimizer based on the select list as the last thing done. And that you just compute it at the end of things. Now, another thing you can do with the auxiliary table. I can show you a couple of tricks with the sequence table. I was pulling out substrings and stuff. But another trick you can do with these is interpolation. Okay, how many people have ever used a slide ruler? For real, not for fun. Oh, good, old people here. It used to be that you'd get a finance book or a calculus book, and in the back there would be trig tables, or compound interest tables, or net present value table, and you'd look them up in the back of the textbook. Cheap calculators did not exist until the 60s. And after they went that cheap when they first came out. But the idea of interpolation is I've got a lookup table, I've got a value that falls in between two values in my lookup table, and I sort of guess, using linear interpolation, as to where, if there was a straight line between those points, if my function was not smooth, but in linear chunks, where my value would be. There's also some other tricks for interpolation with second deltas and finite differences and all that stuff. It's sort of a lost art. If you can find a 1950s engineering book, now usually a section in the back, just before the table, it talks about how to use second deltas and other interpolation things. It's sort of akin to how to use an abacus these days, or divining rods or sundials. But if your grandfather's still alive and was an engineer, you can ask him about it, or me. Probably about the same age. The classic linear formula, pretty easy. And then it can be adapted to some rather ugly SQL gaps that we have to. I'm not necessarily recommending this. It's not as accurate. It's ugly code, but if you need it, yes, it can be done. Yeah, now reading code on slide, isn't that fun?
Once the operating system done?
Oh yeah, that's a big screen.
Will these slides be available?
They should be. I don't know what O'Reilly has done with them. However, if you want to, you can get them from me. In fact, if anybody wants my slides, all of them, I'm very happy to download them. Yeah, bring a disk up or I don't have a drive on this thing, or something, and I'll give you everything I've got.
Do you
email? Yeah, I'll take a while to email and do those. It's going to be a really, that's about 50 presentations. I've never minded handing them out. You know, just leave a copyright notice. That's about all I ask.
How about you
put it
on the web?
I hate to confess this. I've got a website. I never take care of it. I really should, but somehow I just never get around to it. One of my godchildren is doing HTML for a living now. And she's finally got some discussion with it. She's offered to put anything I want on the site if I'll just give her the passwords. I got to take her up on that. Because I know I'm not going to maintain it. I'm just too lazy.
I can put it up
if you maintain it. I don't know why I never got around to it. I had a friend put up the basic website. I looked at it. Well, that's neat. I probably ought to learn to do HTML. Oh, is that all there is to it? Okay, I'll take care of my own website. Yeah, I'll also wash the car and take out the garbage. Other great lies. It's something I really need to do. The little hint about building the calendar tables, math functions, sequence tables, and so on, spreadsheets. They usually have really good temporal and computational functions for the financial stuff. So find out what the accounting department's using. Go over, get them to a spreadsheet of whatever they're doing into a table for the database. So you're actually in sync with the accounting department. So, much as we dislike them, they do cut the paychecks. It's nice to be friends with some of the trolls there. They also review expense accounts. So make sure that you send flowers and a box of chocolates before you put something really dumb on that expense account. And let the troll figure out a good name for it other than drunken orgy. Well, fourth and math packages are out there that have complicated functions to look at. Probably better than spreadsheets. Some of the early Excel spreadsheets, for example, did net present value wrong. The aggregate functions. Well, one of the reasons for having a database is to get some kind of aggregation report out of this. Okay. Now we know my imaginary fault line there. We didn't want SQL to be a statistical language. It didn't start off that way. And we didn't really want to extend it into that. Because how many types of statistics are there? Well, enough to make SAS an expensive package with a really thick manual and a good training program. So we've got min-max, the extreme of function. We've got two listed functions, sum and average. And we've got a family of count functions that count star and count column and count expression are really different, very different. Now, because SQL is such a uniform language, so nicely designed by the incredibly clever people on the committee, if we had an aggregate product function, we know exactly what it would look like. It'd be three letters, PRD, product, to match the sum. And it would be the equivalent of big pi, capital pi, from the college math days. Okay. Well, so there's a little echo. And all the aggregate functions except for count star are defined this way. There's an optional distinct that goes inside the parentheses. By the way, I have no idea why SQL likes to have keywords inside the parentheses of functions as opposed to commas. I have no idea where that came from. Everybody asked. It's what makes SQL look a little different. Every language has that sort of a signature style to it. Well, that's ours. Embedded keywords inside a parameter list. Maybe it goes back to the ALGOL 60 long comma or something.
You don't have an expression in there in the parameter list. It's a set.
Well, but we do think, like, for example, substring has the keywords from and to.
Yeah.
Inside the parentheses. Trim has a whole bunch of keywords that go inside it. And we did the like predicate as an infix operator, which is all over the place.
About aggregates do not have an expression as the input they have in
catch-up.
Technically,
though, the parameter is an expression. The result, of course, is scalar. But in the syntax, it's defined as an expression, which a lot of people don't seem to realize. They can only sum, especially newbies, think they can only do a sum on a column. They can actually do a sum on an expression, and that's where the case expression becomes really powerful. But if I had a product operator, it would operate the same way. Compute the expression, make essentially a column set out of it, remove all the nulls. If I have a distinct, remove the redundant duplicates,
This is another little SQL buzzword thing. Redundant duplicate. You don't remove the duplicates, you remove the redundant duplicates. That's one of those little picky things there. And then I do a multiplication on everything in there. And my scale and precision are implementation defined. This is another one that's sort of weird with SQL. There is no requirement for a particular scale or precision in your results. Ada ran into this problem, and there are federal standards from NIST about at least 5 decimal places for seconds, integers of at least such and such a size, and so on. And no bidder would just do everything to one digit. However, somebody did write an Ada compiler that the implementation definition was one digit for all the computations. And it passed the conformance suite the Army had at the time. So it was one of the few acceptable Ada compilers you could use. And it was an Army group that were during the Ada, at the start of the Ada fiasco. It was sort of interesting, some of the things that came out of that. Anyway, I know what it would look like, I know how it would work, because it's how all aggregates are defined. Now, little trick for the product function, logarithms. Again, since people have actually used a slide rule here, logarithms turn multiplication into addition. I've got an exponential function that's the inverse of logarithms. So I got a function and its inverse, and I can nest my functions inside SQL, including aggregate functions and case expressions, and pretty much anything I want to. New SQL programmers have a real hard time with this nesting functions thing. They're used to doing procedural logic with if-then-elses and hanging loops and stuff like that. Lisp programmers, on the other hand, who are used to lots of insipid, stupid parentheses, that's what Lisp actually stands for, they just, yeah, well, of course, how else would you do it? Of course you just nest things horrendously and push the button. And out comes the table for General Motors. Of course, nobody can read it, but you can't maintain it, but it's there. Now, most SQL products, I'd say probably all, I can't make an exception, have natural logarithms and or base 10 logarithms. I mean, it's easy enough to put into a product, so you go ahead and grab that old math function library, tell the guys that are writing the SQL parser to recognize these names and do the work. So, how about this? Take the exponential of the sum of the logarithms of my numbers to get my product. Okay, what's good? Quick, easy, and all that. Unfortunately, it doesn't work. There's only other little dangers when you're starting to get into non-procedural programming. Listen, procedural programming's got some nice things about debugging it. You can take your if-then-elses, the if-then-goal, print messages. This should not happen. And you get nice little messages back. You were dividing by zero, and the program stops on the particular thing, but the division for you. Yeah. Procedural code's got a lot of advantages for debugging. I'm not going to take it. But the disadvantage, the problem here is logarithms aren't defined for zero or less. Now, depending on whose SQL you're using, you get some really weird results. Sometimes you get null back, sometimes you get zero back, sometimes you get an error message back. Since log and fancy functions are not part of the standard, there's no particular right way to do it. In fact, at one point, Gupta, which is now Tensora, actually had an infinity symbol. When you divide it by zero, you got infinity back. Okay, try using and now you want to work with a front-end host. It's a little better now by triple E floating point having some stuff like NAMs and infinity symbol in it. It's a little more acceptable, but then, 10 years ago, having an infinity pop-up from your database, the nulls were bad enough for most people writing the front end. They didn't know about indicators or anything else, but that was really weird. Okay, fix it. Well, I've got case expressions. This is another one for procedural people. when they see the case expression that came in with the 92 standard, they keep thinking it's a statement and not an expression. They want it to be some kind of control flow thing involved that looks sort of like the case or select or whatever they had in the first language they learned, their first procedural language. And they keep asking about, well, why can't I put another select in the then clause or something? It's pretty different in the manual, or TFM. You don't know what an expression is versus a statement. You're trying to make it into the model you know. Okay, it can be exponential of the sum of the log of a case expression that looks for zeros. And otherwise it turns out the absolute value of the number inside all of this mass. Whew, kind of ugly looking. This is the positive number problem. It's still wrong. Basically, I'm dropping out zero, which is not right. It's sort of a mess. It's a first attempt. Okay, why don't I do some more adjustments, pull some of the case expressions out, and thinking set-oriented, as a case expression that when the minimum absolute value is equal to zero, then a return of zero, well, the return of one would essentially do nothing. Okay, I'm not going to, be patient, this is the way people will scratch paper it out. We'll get to a better result in a minute. But look at the cute little trick for doing stuff in aggregates. My minimum absolute value, guessing functions. I don't know which one is zero. I don't care. Just know that one exists inside an aggregation, inside a grouping, inside a set. This is the thing with the newbies. There's a lot of stuff with the aggregate functions that you can do. The characteristics of the group as a whole without knowing the particulars. Newbies want to write a cursor and look at each one the way they would as if they were in a file system. Don't think that way. Move up to a higher level.
Yeah.
What's the characteristic of the group as a whole that I can write as an aggregate function? Now, a lot of products, especially anything aimed at a data warehouse, will have this information in the statistics table. So they'll know the min, the max, the average, the sum, the count, and so on, as part of the statistical description on the column for the optimizer. So a lot of these questions become just one probe. In the bigger SQL, in the bigger optimizer, in the more storage space. I can also sort of flip it around, move the case expression out, use when exists with it, essentially turning it inside out. Alternate expression, same results, still have a handle negative numbers. This is another thing, the order of the nesting. You're starting to think non-procedurally. What order do I need to have in? What are the alternatives? Which one will run best? Okay, a sort of hideous string of case expressions all inside an aggregate function where I'm checking for my zeros. I'm checking for the count of negative numbers. Remember, negative times negative is positive. So an even count of negative numbers, I get a positive result, and an odd count of negative numbers, I'll get a negative result. So I've got a zero, everything goes to zero, so it doesn't matter. Okay, I can do each of the three cases inside this with case expressions. Yeah, it's ugly looking. Just try to get the concept rather than read the code. There's a little too much to digest before you. And again, I can turn things inside out. Putting the case on the outside instead of the inside. And it's still set ordering calculations. That's all conjugacy. Use of a function and its inverse. Now, a little exercise for you. Try writing the product yourself with a case expression. And try to get, you'll see it's a little trickier than you think, but it can actually be done very compactly when you put the case expression on the outside. You've got three cases. All positive, one zero, and then some negative numbers. Remember, in a case expression, the clauses are checked in the order they're written. So the first one, is evaluated. If it's true, it returns the value within clause, so on all the way down, until you get to the else clause. You don't put in an else clause in a case expression, you're going to null that. A lot of times you'll have to cast that null as a particular data type, be it the compiler again. So an expression has to be one data type. But you try and get a little scratch paper type. You'll see that it worked out pretty well with aggregate functions in the when clauses. Because the optimizer very often has that information in the statistics table, it's actually pretty fast and pretty safe. But it's not the sort of thing that a procedural programmer thinks of. So the case expression was probably one of the best things we ever did for SQL. Min and max, we mentioned, they work on all data types. This is another one that newbies have problems with. They work on all data types. So I can do character string comparisons based on whatever my correlation is. Okay, that's kind of handy, alphabetical order and all that stuff. But it works on temporal data. And first, the view of time is that it's a continuous line, so my minimum time in this set can actually be in the future. And for some reason, this really throws people off. I guess we're too used to thinking of time from a viewpoint of a now with a future and a past. And we don't really see it as a from outside. We're essentially on the train watching it move mentally, as opposed to standing at the station and watching things go by. It's a simple stuff, and min's and max, it's really hard. Again, the usual working, build the list, do the comparison. Oh, by the way, I'm going to issue with the aggregates could have a distinct inside. I think most products are smart enough now that when you say max distinct X, they know that it's garbage. Some of the early SQLs had sort of one pattern for doing the aggregates. So if you said max distinct, it would actually do an extra pass to sort out the duplicates before it returned the max. This is a good little programming trick, actually, in the old days. So you put in some distincts in your mins and maxes to slow your query down. Then when someone complains about it, you go back, you take them out, you recompile them, and you look like a hero. I'm being a little facetious about that, but Henry Camp used to teach at Georgia Tech. He also did the database systems for Days In. Did a medical database for the doctors at Brady Hospital in Atlanta. And as they were getting the data in, you knew that the response time was going to go down. And it was the interesting part is they fill in the blank front end that would begin with English sentences, and the doctors could type in the different phrases or pick them off a pit list, so they had an English language query. It was a pretty simple little front end, so you could ask questions. Greed is a public hospital in Atlanta. So you could ask questions like, how do knife wounds and heart attacks correlate? Since virtually everybody coming to Greed has knife or gunshot wounds. Often a big city with an emergency room. It's very good in a teaching hospital for every university. But so we only had a few thousand records in there. Response time is instant on just about anything. So what Henry did was he put in the lane loops. It would actually slow it down, and then as they got more and more data in, he'd make the loop shorter and shorter until he finally just removed them. The result was the user, hey, it's just as fast at 100,000 records as it was at 10,000 records. It's just as fast at 250,000 records as it was at 100,000. They didn't perceive any change in performance. Doctors are not willing to learn. I know this is silver. We're not willing to learn anything outside medicine. And they're very impatient. Now. Well, if you're working in an emergency room, or my wife did 13 years on a cancer ward, you really do get a sense of urgency because people are dying. It's not a matter of my computer crashed and it's a bad thing. It's a matter of a heart monitor crashed. It's a really bad thing. So you can sort of see their model. But if you can't change the problem, change the user. Or change its perception. Human interface does an awful lot of nice stuff. But okay, I don't know how to use aggregates to get through characteristics. If the min value in a column is the same as the max value in a column, what do we know about all the elements in the column? Same. It didn't have to go through and count each one. It didn't have to look at it. I don't even know what the value of x is. I just know this is a set of things that are all the same. Aggregate functions cannot be nested. That's another one that newbies miss. Essentially, because the result is a set, they have to be all of the same kind of thing. Different levels of aggregation are different kinds of things, so it just doesn't work. I'll say something nice about Oracle. It's not standard, but it's pretty handy. They have greatest and least that looks at a list of values. The way coalesce takes a list and returns the lowest to the highest. I kind of wish we'd got that in the standard. It's pretty handy for a number of things. I can fake it by essentially putting my values in a one-column table and doing a min and a max on it. It's kind of ugly. I'd really rather have the greatest and least. But if I need it, I can fake it. Top-end values, this exists in a couple of versions, mostly the Microsoft thing. One version has access to where it really started. And it assumes I've got an ordering so I can talk about the first five, the last five, or whatever I want to cut off. To be honest, it's best done procedurally. Don't look up the old partition algorithm for quicksort. Modify it slightly and you've got the best way to do it. Now, procedural approach is sort the file, read in the records, right off the top, hanging loose. We've got a couple of problems, of course. The specs are bad. This is the other one. Since it's a non-procedural language and you've got to tell it what to do, the SQL programmer has a horror of finding out that good specs are really hard to write. And it's not just management that can't do it. A lot of times we can't do it either. I don't know if anyone's over anonymous anything, but he was one of the first guys to really get into the formal structured programming and proofs of correctness and that kind of thing. He used to do a demo about the specs for sorting an array. And all these ways they could be blown. So now, what's the sort of array? Well, the values are in numeric order according to the position of the array. So one way to do it, simply fill the array in with fixed values, no matter what was there originally. Next method produces the desired result. Reduce the array to one cell, cutting off everything else. So whatever left is in sorted order. And you have about four or five ways of doing it to completely destroy the data. Put that in specs. Well, he ain't the only one. In this case, I say go pick the top N items. What do I do about ties? I want my top three salesmen based on their sales. Okay, everybody quit. I've got two salesmen. Do we still have a contest that month? Put in all three of them. So exactly the same amount. Does everybody get a reward? The specs aren't clear. So subset approach, they got to decide whether ties count or not. In a pure set model, maybe not. SQL really is a multi-set or bag model, so maybe I want to keep ties. And essentially I'm saying I want to find a subset from this set within or fewer distinct values that are higher than some value. Basic self-joint. I'm going to use one of the subsets to establish a boundary, and one of the other subsets to establish the elements inside that boundary. Essentially, essentially, if I want to find the highest three values, I want to cut out these guys as a separate set. So, I'm going to look at their count, and if it's greater than a particular number that I'm putting in, I've established my boundary. And anything greater than that falls inside my range. So here's salaries from an employee's table. Now, I can play all kinds of games with the greater than, less than signs as to how I want to establish my boundaries. It's the guy on the boundary now. I can throw in a select or a select distinct, depending how I want to handle duplicates. If you play around with that query, just making those little changes, you might want to two combinations for the select, the outer select, two combinations for the comparison. Two times, I got four ways of doing this. Well, which one did I mean? Well, I don't know, let's just show it to the user, who probably doesn't know what he meant anyway. Had that problem, everybody? Why didn't you do what I meant instead of what I told you? Why did you make that assumption? Well, because it seemed reasonable, sir. Why didn't you keep me from making that assumption? Because everybody knows what I'm thinking. Right?
I got a question on this slide.
Yeah.
So, n is the number?
Yeah.
The top?
Yeah, that I want to find is the salary. Now, as I said, you're going to get different combinations, and pies are going to be handled a little differently. Essentially, one copy acts as the boundary, the other copy acts as the elements inside the set.
It goes through the boundary.
Yeah. It's a little expensive in some cases. Other cases, it runs pretty fast. I haven't really got a good rule for that. Well, it really depends on the indexing. I can also do this with a group by, where I essentially put the count in the having clause. Oh, other little thing that a lot of people have realized about group by and having. You don't have to have a group by to go in the having clause. You can have a having clause by itself. What it does is it treats the entire select as if it was one group and will return one result. So you know, select salary from blah, 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 having some less than 42. So the whole query has a sum less than 42. I pass a having clause and I return the group. If it doesn't, I return nothing. That's the other thing with count. It's a little weird. Count star is really a cardinality operator. We're sort of stuck in the count star syntax. It really, really should have been something like cardinality paren set expression, close paren. Because you've got little differences between you've got an empty set. Count star will return a count of zero. If I do a count on an expression and I've got an empty set, I get an empty set back. I don't get a zero. And you can play some games with this that get a little weird, especially when you throw in the type case expressions. That's one where you really need to sit down and see the code. Just how aggregates work. They're trickier and more useful than people think. Aggregates are not just for summary reports anymore. They're really good for queries. Just like beer is not for breakfast anymore. Well, just for breakfast anymore. Now, I'm going to go into trees and SQL, and I'm going to, yeah, we're okay, 10:15 is the break. I'm only going to work on one method in depth, that's nested set. That's partly because it's my favorite, my name's associated with it, blah, blah, blah. But if you want to get into other methods for doing trees and hierarchies, okay, shameless plug time. I have a new book out on nothing but trees and hierarchies in SQL. Buy it, buy copies for your friends, give one to your mother who isn't going to read it anyway. But I really do need to make rent payments. Yeah, I'm an author. I'm a writer. I'm in it for the money. Parts explosions, organizational charts, any kind of hierarchy. In particular, when I say hierarchies, what you're finding a lot more today is that, especially through dimension tables on a data warehouse, they're usually hierarchical. I look at the days, weeks, months, years on temporal dimension. I look at an organizational structure, sales team, division, corporate, whatever. I've got as a company. And so you really do need to represent a lot more hierarchy than we originally thought. I don't know, SQL has sort of a funny history with this. The original database, has anybody worked with IMS? Now I've gotten old again. But it was one of the first commercial successful products. There's still more stuff in IMS than there is in SQL in the real world. It was a good product for commercial use as long as you were doing everything the same way. But that was very hierarchical. And the argument against SQL initially was, well, you know, these tables and this really funny looking algebra language thingy bob for getting to them. Yeah, that's pretty good, but it's only going to be good for ad hoc queries. You know, you don't do really serious work like a payroll or insurance processing or something we're going to be stuck with IMS and IDMS until the end of time. It just can't handle hierarchies. And then, of course, among the SQL people, we actually get production-grade, large SQL databases, and we don't even know hierarchies. We don't even know stinking hierarchies. Along comes XML, and hierarchies are suddenly back in. Along comes dimension table, and hierarchies are suddenly back in and cool. I think XML probably did the nicest job of giving files a good name again. Now, before that, everything was going to database. There's a Gilbert cartoon from 1996 of the gang sitting around the table with a pointy-haired boss. And the boss says, "We're going to begin a new project." And Wally pipes up, "Great, let's build a database. You haven't heard what the project is yet." "Yeah, but we like to build databases." Yeah, it was the attitude for a long time. And in particular, SQL databases, so we didn't have no stinking hierarchies. If anybody here knows Fabian Pascal's stuff, he's busy tap-dancing on XML as the great Satan that's going to destroy the world currently, because it's hierarchical. Hierarchies can be our friends. Real quick, terminology thing. Everybody had a little different set of terms for stuff inside trees depending on what your textbook was. But pretty much everybody agreed that a tree has a root at the top, and stuff at the bottom that doesn't have any subordinates were called leaf nodes. But in between, everybody disagreed as to whether or not to use biology, matrilineal or patrilineal terms. So you'll see it sort of all over the place. So you'll see parent and child, you'll see father, son, you'll see mother, daughter even in a few books. So it's sort of all over the place. It's a mixture of botany and genealogy in the terms. If you're from Arkansas and you don't have a family tree, you have a family bush. I'm currently living in Utah, where the DNA really is actually worse than Arkansas. But there's a wonderful little cartoon. In the ICFOS, the Christian fish symbol that you see on the back of bumpers. In Utah, they have one with a big fish, three little fishes, a whole school of smaller fish behind them. That's the more than Christian fish. But we usually do trees as a graph. Why? Well, boxes and arrows look nice and they're easy to read. So here's my little five nodes. Organization, parts explosion, whatever. Where Mr. Root has two immediate subordinates, and A0 has two immediate subordinates, and 4B0 is hoping to build an empire someday. Oh, he hangs out. I can also represent a tree as nested sets. And another little old age thing. How many people had Canoe, The Art of Programming, as your textbook in college? If you don't have a copy of it, it's expensive as hell. It's like $175 for the three volume set. Get it. It's actually worth it. It's one of those things where if you look at the bibliographic sightings, Ed Dykstra doesn't quote anybody. He references nobody. All his work's original. You go with Canoe, it's the other extreme. He references everybody. Yeah, eventually you have a Canute number where it's how many spaces away from being referenced by the arm. But he actually did this in one of the first textbooks. The idea is that I show subordination by continuing. That looked an awful lot like parentheses. HTML tags, XML tags. Yeah. They're all essentially nested set representations of hierarchies. So it's initially for people to go to the boxes and arrows, the pointer chains. The boxes and arrows model, the adjacency list model, where it has boss and subordinates columns, was natural because it looked like pointer chains. This is what they grew up with. For people who grew up with XML, HTML, the tag languages, this actually looks more natural to them. So let's take a look at the table.